go any further, I'm going to help you to understand what this text is, in just in the sense of what is where, if you see what I mean. So a little bit of boring housekeeping. Okay, so if you start on page one, of course, at the top you've got the contraction, the two verses which summarise the nine headings into which the text is divided. Then you've got the statement in prose of what those nine aspects are. So then the fourth paragraph sets out what is the essence of ethics. Do you remember those four aspects of the essence of ethics? And that's continued to the bottom of the page. The last para, last bit of a para, gives the benefits of the essence of ethics. Okay? So if you turn over, the that paragraph is continued, and then the first complete paragraph deals with complete ethics. It defines what is meant by complete ethics, the lay side and the monastic side. Then the next para talks about the three types of ethics, the three aspects of ethics, the three levels of ethics, that is, the ethics of the vow, of collecting wholesome factors, and the ethics of benefiting living beings. Then the next para, starting among them, the ethics of the vow, deals with the ethics of the vow. At least what's happening here is it's saying what these mean in general, if you see what I mean. Then the next para, the ethics of collecting wholesome factors, the next two paras, in fact, are to do with the collecting of wholesome factors. Okay, then at the bottom of page two, there's a brief statement of the ethics of benefiting sentient beings, which is what we're going to mainly deal with today. And that's continued on page three. The remains of that para is on page three. So what we've done now is we've defined the essence of ethics, and we've made a brief statement about the three kinds of ethics. Now what happens is that we explore how to develop each of those aspects. So the remaining two paras on page three, the last para on page three is to do with developing the ethics of the vow. That goes on to page four, right down to the bottom of page four. And then the last para, half para on page four, is how to develop the ethics of developing wholesome factors. And that continues, the remains of that para on page five, and then another para. So, what happens now is the 11 aspects of developing the ethics of benefiting living beings. So that starts on page five, the fourth para. Okay, some of you followed that anyway, but just to give you a broad idea of what the text is. Before I start doing the 11 modes for benefiting living beings, I want to just remind us of where we've come from. First of all, we've established this has been set up, it's funny. Yes, I want to remind you of where we've come from. First of all, we've established that ethics is naturalistic, is natural. Ethics is implicit in our consciousness. Awareness is awareness of connection, if you like, connection with life. And therefore, it's an awareness of the breaking of that connection or the enhancement of that connection. It's not something you have to learn. Well, in a way you do. It's not something you have to add on to consciousness. It's something you have to draw out of consciousness. This is extremely important. In the Buddhist context, ethics is always natural. It's located in us. And any system, any codes or whatever, are simply to help us to sensitize, ethically sensitize ourselves more and more. I remember when I first came across this text, although I'd heard those sort of things before, it made a tremendous impact on me. The recognition that ethics is, entirely natural, just like the sense of beauty is, something that you simply have to recognize in yourself and allow to unfold, or even create the conditions for its unfolding. I think if we can really grasp this, to understand that human consciousness has already value implicit within us, the capacity for value experience is within consciousness. Of course, it's not developed, and often it's even cramped by our cultural circumstances or our even psychological experience, early conditioning. It actually cramps that natural capacity for responsiveness. But that means then we have to unfold it. But it's something we're unfolding, something we're imposing on ourselves, sort of forcing into ourselves. So everything we deal with, there's loads and loads of lists in this text, and lots of ceremonies and vow takings and so forth, they're all about helping us to unfold something that is naturally a capacity we have. And the broad outlines of how you do that are given by a Sangha in terms of these four aspects: correctly receiving it from somebody else, having a quite purified intention, making correction after failure, and maintaining mindfulness of respect for the other so that you don't fail. Keeping in mind your ethical connection with your teachers and your fellow community members, your brothers and sisters in the spiritual community, that helps you to keep alive your ethical sensitivity and therefore not to break it. That's it. That's ethics, really. The lists just help you to draw that out. Very, very simple in a way, but very profound. I think one of the most important things, again, that I get from this text is it clarifies the relational quality of ethics. Obviously ethics is relational, because if I hit you, I'm after all hitting you, if you see what I mean. It's a relationship, not a very good one. But it's a relationship. The development of ethics is equally, if not, you could say, more so, relational. I need to be in relation to ethical beings so that my own ethics unfolds. It's one of the key elements in having a spiritual community. Of course, you also need work on your own, you need solitude, you need meditation in solitude, and so forth. But that must be paralleled by complemented by relationship to others. That doesn't mean loads of chatting and so forth, but it means standing in an ethical relationship, especially to teachers, but also to, on a more horizontal scale, to your friends. And in the ideal circumstance, you'd be part of an ethical gathering of some kind, some regular circumstance or situation in which your ethics is on the table, and everybody else's too, in which you all share your practice of the precepts. This is what Buddhist tradition enjoined right from the start. The monastic sanghas, men's and women's, consisted of principally of regular Uposatha meetings, that is, meetings on the full moon night and half moon night, when they would basically confess. They'd go through the Vinaya, the list of monastic rules, principles, and if you'd broken a precept, you'd say, "Yep, I've done it." Then you'd be asked to explain why, how it came about, and you'd be given some means of rectifying it. So that is absolutely essential to Buddhist practice. Again, I'm not sure how much this is alive in the modern Western Buddhist world. In our order and community, we try to make this integral. Unfortunately, we've got rather, a heritage of a more sort of psychological approach to things. So sometimes such groupings can degenerate into mere sort of mutual analysis or self-analysis in front of another. But they should be, ideally, ethical gatherings where the standards are the precepts and where, in a gentle, kindly but merciless way, uncompromising way, that's a better word, ethics are on the table, if you see what I mean. We should be able to say to each other, that was really unskillful. And, then to discuss. And because if you can face the fact that it was unskillful, you can do something about it. If you refuse to face the fact that it was unskillful, then, it remains within your consciousness, as it were, as a discord. There's something in you that's blocked. So Asanga's really stressing in this text this context of ethical engagement. In many chapters of the order, that will be the case. People will begin by confessing. And some will even have a sort of formula for it. So everybody will have a chance, one after the other, to confess. And then there'll be some exploration, pretty much along the lines I suggested at the beginning. But just making sure the person really feels remorse. Because no remorse, no confession. Then making sure that confession is full, that what was done is really explored. What about this? What about that? And all in a kindly context, because we're all going to be doing it, if you see what I mean. And then, how did it happen? What were the inner circumstances that allowed that action or speech or whatever to take place? And then, what are you going to do about it? Have you spoken to the person you harmed? Have you done what you can to put it right, if that's possible? And that's the sort of situation where you can get some feedback whether it is possible or not, if you see what I mean. Because sometimes it just isn't, and it's best not to go into it straight away. But you need confirmation that you're not just wriggling from people who are a bit punctilious ethically. And then how are you not going to do it again? How are you going to stop yourself from doing it again? All in a non-blaming context, if you see what I mean. Yes, uncompromising in the sense of not trying to palliate or minimise what cannot be minimised. And of course, sometimes saying, I don't think that anything wrong with that. I think you've got mixed up there. It's a bit of ethical clarification. But I think if you really want to make progress ethically, I'm going to say, really, if you want to make progress dhammically, you need to be making progress ethically. And if you want to be making progress ethically, you need to be in a context where all this is open where you can really explore what you have done and also explore what others have done, because oddly, others' unskillfulness is often very closely related to your own, if you see what I mean. And sometimes in hearing others confess, you sort of realize there are things in yourself. Again, I should stress that this is not a terrible mutual scourging, with chains lashing your back. It's not like that. Actually, if it goes well, it's very joyful, oddly, because you feel, as it goes on, more and more of, what's the Pali? Avipratisara, this innocence, this freedom from guilt, which is delightful. You can all do all this in solitude. If you're on a solitary retreat, for instance, things come up. I did a very long solitary retreat in 2008, and I had to wade through my whole history, as it were, things I'd forgotten about, the way I behaved to my first girlfriend, all sorts of things which I'd just completely forgotten about. But they all come up, one after another. And, there's nobody to tell them to, so you just have to sort of, I just started telling the Buddha. I don't mind telling you. I just sort of speak it out, make offerings. And I felt this sort of cleaning going on, as if my mind was becoming purer and purer and clearer and clearer. Got a bit spooky when I realized there were things in there that didn't come from this life, but that's another story. I managed to clean some of that too. But if you can, you must do it with others, because often what holds us back is social shame. In other words, not wanting others to think you're bad. So you hold back. And it's really effective when you can speak it out to others. It becomes a very powerful cleansing of the mind. Without that, Buddhist tradition is unanimous. You cannot make deep progress. You can make progress, you can even have some degree of realization, but you cannot complete that unless you do this much deeper clearing out, cleansing. Many Buddhist traditions have sort of formulae for starting intensive retreats, thinking particularly of a sort of outline of a three-month intensive course by the great Chinese master Zhe Yi. It's in that book published as Dhyana for Beginners, that passage in the Buddhist Bible called Dhyana for Beginners. Buddhist Bible is only the publisher's title, by the way. But he describes how at the beginning of the retreat, you just do a lot of confession, a lot of prostrations, a lot of burning of incense, a lot of recitation of confessional verses, and a lot of actual self exposure, confessing yourself, all in this extremely positive context. That's the point. So this is the first thing that the text teaches us, that ethics is natural, but it needs to be worked out in relationship to an ethical community. And without this, in a sense, we could say that we cannot go further and deeper. We can, but you can't sustain it. You can get some depth of meditation. Some people have a great facility for meditation and can get quite deeply into meditation without resolving everything. But they will come back, and that will need resolving. Some people can have quite deep experiences, which we might call insight, but without that deeper foundation in innocence of mind, it will not be possible to stabilize and complete that. And if you have any degree of insight, it should reveal to you that's what you've got to do, if you see what I mean. So this is the first lesson, if you like, of the text. That's taken a bit further by this idea of the three kinds of ethics. Saying they're three kinds, and that is the way they're put here, suggests they're sort of co-equals. And in a sense, in the Bodhisattva's life, they are co-equals. But they also represent a set of steps. They're a bit like Sila, Samadhi, Prajna, ethics, meditation, wisdom in the classic teaching, the Buddha's last message. It's a set of grades of steps, but as it were within Sīla, so that Sīla, to begin with, seems like something in particular. Then as you go further, it changes into something else. Or it's not that it changes into something else, but something else is revealed that needs to be dealt with. And then when you begin to deal with that, something further begins to emerge. So you could say that the ethics of the vow, which broadly you could say consists in restraining yourself from unethical behaviour and schooling yourself in behaviour that is harmless, if you see what I mean, putting yourself on retreat, where you can't do a lot of harm, and following a programme, having a routine, a disciplined routine. It's the ethics of the vow is about disciplining your life so that it holds you back from unskillfulness. Don't go there. If you know you get into trouble when you do that, don't go there. You have to make little rules for yourself often. Well, I do. I have to make rules for using my my tablet, because otherwise, it can occupy the whole day just fiddling around on the internet. You have to sort of school yourself not to. And so on. So the ethics of restraint or the vow is placing around yourself restrictions that will help you to not get into unskillful states and that will encourage you to get into to skillful ones. Very much the grain of against the grain of the times, isn't it? Where the idea is we should follow our inner instinct. Well, that's all very well as long as your inner instinct is sufficiently deep and creative. Unfortunately, it often isn't. Often it simply means following your whims. And a whimsical life is a pretty useless one, or at best, and a destructive one at worst. So most people will need some degree of self-discipline, of body, speech, and mind. And that is what the ethics of the vow is about. And this is the sort of thing that in your ethical community you can work out. And it's customary indeed for people to make vows, whether it's to stop smoking or to not drink or to not eat meat or not to get associated with a certain situation that always spins out of control, whatever it is, not to say certain things, to restrain the tongue, not to swear, whatever it is. Often in that ethical community, you will try to deal with your own tendencies by putting in place vows. Of course, they need to be intelligently done. I don't know whether you remember as a child, well, maybe you didn't do this, but as a child, we always used to take New Year's resolutions. And I remember making long, long lists of New Year's resolutions. And I doubt if they lasted till the 2nd of January. And I doubt if I even remembered that I'd taken them. It's pretty useless. Taking of vows and then not keeping them weakens the notion of vow. So that the ethics of the vow requires a sensible, intelligent, practicable a perspective negotiated in your ethical community. So that's a first step. You need to restrain yourself from the things that you do or think or say that sully your mind. And of course, that gets more and more subtle as you practice more and more deeply. You begin to be more and more sensitive to this. And I doubt if many people can do without that sort of restraint, certainly not for the early part of one's spiritual career, in other words, for the first few lifetimes. I think it is inevitably a part of that spiritual life to discipline oneself. But of course, it's not enough. It's not enough just to have a harmless life. It needs to be creating benefit. You need to be creating positive mental states. Otherwise, you might as well slit your throat, because at least you're not harmful then. There needs to be the... sorry about that. or anaesthetize yourself or something like that. Some people do try that. Yes, you need to be cultivating skillful states of mind. You need to be doing the things that promote skillful action, skillful speech, skillful states of mind. In a way, you're doing it at this level simply to get into a better state. Of course, doing something that's skillful involves benefiting other people, probably. So other people are definitely part of this. But at this stage, your motive is mainly selfish, which is fine. Your motive is mainly to benefit yourself and to be in a better state of mind yourself. After all, metta begins with self-metta. So you're practicing metta bhavana, you're developing the positive sides of the precepts, and so on. The text has quite a bit to say about this, mainly in terms of the paramitas, including prajna paramita, interestingly enough. So this is mainly the stage of what in the threefold way is meditation. It's in meditation, when you have Shila, Samadhi, Prajna, Samadhi really is the cultivation of skillful mental states. So you're trying to develop an uninterrupted flow of skillful mental states. That's Bhante's definition of meditation, isn't it? It's an uninterrupted flow of skillful mental states, and of course, the skillful actions of body and speech that flow from that state of mind. But, that's not enough. That's not the end of ethics. And I imagine everybody's got some sort of glimpse of this, but I want to try and illustrate it a little bit from my own experience, such as it is. I realized that when I took on certain responsibilities, for instance, when I became the chairman of the LBC, when the LBC was just founded, I was the first chairman for my sins and for other people's. I began to realize that my own actions had a bigger impact than they did before, if you see what I mean. When I'm a private citizen, so to speak, the odd cursing and swearing, the odd expletive, the odd expression of irritation has an effect, no doubt. It's not pleasant to be the recipient of it, particularly to one's nearest and dearest, who are usually the recipients, at least of mine. But when you take on greater responsibility, especially in a context which is to do with values, your lapses in skillfulness have a far greater impact, a disproportionate impact. Your own character has an impact beyond what seems relevant, what seems immediately fair, if you see what I mean. For instance, those of you who know me, and by now most of you have known me for at least 4.5 hours, you know that I never speak mildly. I always express myself forcefully and definitely, even when I have no idea what I'm talking about. I'm gifted with certainty. And others are cursed with my certainty. Joking apart, yes, I do have a certain forcefulness of manner, which is just to do with the fact that my father was a naval officer and my mother was a New Zealander. You know, Maitri Vajri, sort of. Think of Maitri Vajri. So, you know, I came out with a certain sort of commanding personality, if you see what I mean. But when you get into a situation where people actually are sort of looking to you, you have to take responsibility for the effect that that has. It's quite innocent. I really don't mean to intimidate or overwhelm or force, but I have to take responsibility for it. God, I wish I hadn't started saying all this. do you see what I mean? That when you start to take on greater responsibility, especially in a context of value, I imagine it's all right if you're, you know, an officer in the Royal Navy or whatever, you can be a bit grumpy every now and again, and it just goes with the territory, so to speak. But if you're working in a context that is a spiritual community, where what you're trying to bring into being is this very, very sensitive, very skillful relationship between people, how can you do that on the basis of anything in you that is likely to be problematic, if you see what I mean? Of course, you can never stop being you, but you've got to try to take that into account. Seems grossly unfair. It really does seem unfair, but you've sort of got to. So when you start to take on a greater responsibility in relation to others, which is, after all, a little tiny corner of what the Bodhisattva ideal is about, then new ethical imperatives play upon you, what I call the ethics of responsibility. You have to be up to the mark yourself. I remember this when I first started doing ordinations and having to decide whether people were ready for ordination. I remember that the first thing that sort of struck me was, what about me? What about me? Am I ready? And it sort of throws you back on yourself. It calls your own going for refuge to the three jewels into question. And, well, in a way, I was quite pleased that I felt that, because it meant that I was probably on the right track, if you see what I mean. If it didn't call my own into question, it meant that I was standing in some abstract seat of judgment deciding about other people. So there has to be a sort of recognition that my going for refuge is called into question, and that the judgment I am making is the best I can do at the moment, given who I am, given what I know, given the circumstances. So new ethical standards come into play. New kinds of ethical imperative come into play. I find this both humbling and frightening and sort of reassuring. You know, when I'm in India, for instance, I'm an educated Westerner. Most of the people I'm dealing with are from so-called low-caste background. They have education nowadays, but it's certainly not the same standard as Western education. Certainly the one I got a very good education. My parents paid for it. It's not the same. And I'm much more confident because I come from this Western Britain where, you know, you basically, if you come from a background like mine, you just think you can do anything. I always thought I could fly if I really wanted to, because that's the way I was sort of brought up. These people haven't. So I have to take responsibility for myself in relation to them. And I have to take responsibility for the fact that within a traditional society, it's easy for people to give responsibility to leaders. And so you have to try to work with that in a creative way so that, yeah, some leadership is required. But you have to make sure that leadership hands responsibility back, doesn't eat it all up. And it's so easy for that to happen. I've done it. Done it 100 times. So a new kind of ethical responsibility comes about, especially when you're working between different cultures which is frightening. I know I'll never really understand Indian culture, and they'll never understand me. We can sort of meet in that non-understanding in a very, very positive and deep way. But there's things I'll never really know about how I impact and how I'm received. So I have to take responsibility for that. I can't say, well, that's not my problem. I'm just as I am. I'm just me. I just can't do that. Of course, you know, you never know what you don't know, but you have to try to work with it. So the bodhisattva begins to take responsibility for his or her impact in the world. Every one of us has to be something, if you see what I mean. If you exist within space and time, you have to be particular. You have to be from this particular space at this particular time. Do you see what I mean? You can't live outside time, being, as they say, all things to all. You are what you are. I'm white, I'm English, I'm middle class. I come from a certain age, an era. I came from a certain background. All of that I carry in me, I carry with me. And it's not my fault. I didn't ask to be born into that, so far as I'm aware. It just happened to me. And in a way, it's innocent, but I sort of have to start taking responsibility for how that plays out and how that impacts in the world around me. I'm male, that has an effect, and so on. You know, need I multiply? So we need to take responsibility for who we are and how that impacts in the world around us, and we need to try to work out how to take this greater responsibility, which, as we're pursuing the bodhisattva path, grows into, well, it's spoken of as responsibility towards all sentient beings. I mean, in a way, that's absolutely ridiculous. How can I personally take responsibility for all sentient beings? I find it difficult enough taking responsibility for one, the one that whose face I shave occasionally. That's mine, by the way, I don't. just in case my metaphor was too elliptical. But nominally, that sort of ideally, the bodhisattva is responsible towards all sentient beings. And one will be, as one develops spiritually, as one goes beyond self-clinging more and more deeply, one will be more and more becoming deeply responsible. Responsible for the world around one. Well, we'll feel one's actions in relation to the world around you. Probably most people are sort of aware of this horrible tension when you hear the news and you hear the dreadful suffering that there is in the world. Dreadful suffering. And in a way, you just don't know what to do about it. And you either fall into news anesthesia, where it's just another bit of information, with perhaps a little bit of titillation about it, because then you've got something to talk about, at worst. Or you basically say, oh, well, that doesn't bother me. It's not coming my way, that typhoon or tsunami or riot or uprising doesn't touch me. So one becomes anaesthetized to the suffering in the world. The other extreme, of course, is where you become horrified, overwhelmed, depressed, sort of implodes upon you. Most of us sort of steer some sort of path in between. Bodhisattva takes responsibility for it all. Doesn't mean that he or she rushes off to Somalia and tries to stop the situation there. It can't be done. It's not like that. But it means that what he or she does do is done in relation to that, if you see what I mean. So that you know that what you are doing is a contribution to that. even if a distant one, and you know that you are a part of a trend that is trying to deal with that, the larger community of those who are trying to bring benefit to living beings. The Bodhisattva Sangha, but it's not just Buddhists, as it were. All those who are trying to do something good in the world, however clearly or mindfully or whatever. So you take responsibility more and more and more as you become less and less self-centered. As you become less and less self-centered, life doesn't just turn back on me. I hear the news, what's it mean to me? See some suffering, what's it mean to me? So that everything is measured by self. As you begin to free yourself from selfishness, which you do, of course, by meditation practice, by practice of vipassana of one kind or another, and also by the ethics of restraint and the ethics of collecting wholesome factors. Because as you're developing wholesome factors, your mind becomes more and more attuned to the world around you. You become less and less separate from it. You're resonating with it. I think of this as vipassana in the context of ethics. We think of vipassana mainly in the context of meditation and reflection in the context of meditation. But vipassana also happens in the context of ethics, because you're trying to develop a more and more selfless kind of behaviour. And when you come on to a point where you really are a bit free from selfish clinging, then you have to take on more and more of an ethical responsibility for the larger world around you. And this is what we're going to be exploring in the 11 modes of the ethics of benefiting living beings. So, yes, I hope that you get some idea of the progression that there is from this ethics of restraint, which is really just about stopping yourself from doing something that will create negative karma for you, unskillful karma for you, will cause you to fall into lower or lesser states. And then moving on to the ethics of cultivating skillful mental states, kushla dhamma, dhamma here meaning mental states. Parigraha means accumulation, gathering together. Kushla dhamma parigraha, shila. So you start to cultivate skillful action, skillful states, because those are skillful, they feel good, you feel happy, and they create a happy future. They create good karma, punya karma, so that you get a better and better sort of result in life. Again, I do stress, it doesn't mean that you avoid all suffering. Planes crash, whether it's all the passengers are skillful or not, if you see what I mean, unskillful or not. Cancer gets you whether you're skillful or not, broadly speaking. Although I think mental states have a big effect on physical health, but your life becomes smoother, more pleasant. You feel happier, and you feel more in tune with the world around you. And that attunement leads you to the point at which, you feel, as it were, no separation. You feel yourself part of the whole. You feel yourself to be a condition amongst other conditions. And you begin to accept, so to speak, full responsibility for the nature and kind of that conditioning and how it interacts, and for the total field of experience. And these 11 modes are supposed to be a guide to how you do that. I have to say that the list is a little bit, what can I say? It's not easy to say why it's sort of drawn up exactly in the way that it is. And sometimes it's a bit repetitive. One often finds that looking at particularly Abhidhamma texts from early Buddhism. They don't seem to classify things in the same way that I do, at least. So you'll get, you know, a category that goes apples, pears, bananas, oranges, and cabbages. And you think, well, why have they put cabbages there? And then suddenly telephones are there. There is some logic behind it, but it's 2,000 years ago, and I can't figure it out quite. So I'm not going to be able to give you an exhaustive sort of logic for the whole thing. And maybe it doesn't actually have one. Maybe it's just sort of various slices through the issue, if you see what I mean. It's interesting, the text says, the bodhisattva is equipped with one of these modes and all of these modes. So that suggests that each of these modes is not separable from the others, that if you sort of examine one, you're really examining the others. Very often this is the case, isn't it, with spiritual principles. They're not separable. They're not really so subject to analysis and logic, much to the frustration of people with my particular character, which is an analytic one, as it were. So we won't be able to find, probably won't be able to find a strict logic to it. But we'll tackle it as best we can in the next day and a half, and we'll see what we can make of it, what we can draw from it. And we'll wait until we meet again after a tea break, because we need all our strength to take on the ethics of benefiting living beings, because it's inevitably a stretch beyond us. All of us have more work to do on level one, if not on the level before that, and level two. But it's good to see where we're trying to get to, and we can begin to practice in that sort of way. And none of us are sort of uniquely at one level or the other. We're all of us spread a bit. We're on a path of irregular steps, and we have our moments of bodhisattva practice and our moments of not really even being restrained. So it's sort of irrelevant to us, but at the same time relevant. And with that enigmatic phrase, I'll meet you at 12 o'clock.